Well, it's a quiet week in Lake Wobegon. It's the weekend before Halloween on Monday. All the kids get all dressed up, of course, and go out trick-or-treating, and there are a few parties in Lake Wobegon, and everybody has a lot of fun, but it's nothing like it used to be. This is one of the cases where that really is true. I was introduced to Halloween by my classmate Merle Krause, who was in shop with me and who always did so much better at everything, and especially the projects that had to do with electricity. He had a real talent for wiring things up. Now, this was in a different day and age when it came to Halloween. Halloween was open warfare for about 24 hours. This has all gone away somewhere, and we could talk for a long time about why. Technology or something got in the way. But when I was a boy, it was warfare between people pulling tricks on each other. And there were certain rules, of course. There was always a code involved, but it was a day and a night when you wanted to be very, very careful. And when you walked over to start your car, you wanted to check to see if there are any wires running towards it. And you wanted to smell to see if there might be some kind of rockets that are hooked up to your spark plugs underneath. You want to be careful about lifting up your hood, though, because things might jump out at you. And you wanted to check the floor of your car, make sure there weren't snakes or something in there, some odd thing in your car. You always locked your door for Halloween if you ever went away, which you wouldn't really want to do because you wanted to be sure somebody wouldn't have time to, say, put a cow in your upstairs bedroom. This could be done by a patient person who had a cow. And what a cow could do in a few hours up in your bedroom, you just don't even want to know about. The smell would not go away for years and years and years. Now, there was a code here. The purpose was to harass and irritate people, not to injure. You shouldn't injure anybody. And you shouldn't cause actual destruction. There was respect on the part of the victim for the ingenuity of the perpetrators of the prank, whatever it was. When you came home and you found your Model T Ford up on the roof of the garage, you admired the patience and the hard work of somebody who took that car apart and then put it back together up there. You honestly did. You didn't get mad. You got even. But you realized that whatever you did, you were responsible for the consequences, whether you had intended them or not. So that if you decided to pick on Mr. Berge, the town drunk, and you put six geese in the trunk of his car as he was sitting in the sidetrack tap and celebrating, and then you asked if you could borrow his jack, and he came out and he opened the trunk and those geese came boiling out of the trunk and they tore around town and you couldn't find them all and they went after some of those little kids who were trick-or-treating. You are responsible for what happened. And if years later one of those little kids grown up is lying on a psychiatrist's couch in a darkened office on the east side of Manhattan going back to childhood and fingers that night as the point where his anxiety started that led to this divorce, this end of his fourth marriage, you are in some way responsible for that. If you decide to let all the cattle out to meander down Main Street as a wonderful joke for Halloween, and if somebody should run into a cow, you're responsible for all the damages, and your parents are going to have to pay for this, and things may be quiet and tense around your home for a long time to come. Merle loved Halloween. Now, back in those days, of course, there was all sorts of things you could do that you can't do today because cars have changed. This was back when, on Sunday night, boys with cars would drive up and down, back and forth, on the main street, the length of the street, to show off their cars. Now, he just had a 48 Ford, which was not a big show car compared to the 57 Chev or the Model T. And so cars like to pull up right close behind him and honk at Merle. And so he rigged up a wire from his spark plug, threw a switch under the dashboard and down to the end of his tailpipe. And back then, if you revved up your car and you pumped the gas, and then you took your foot off the gas, a lot of unburned gas came out the tailpipe. And then you just flicked that switch and 6 feet of flame came out of the manifold. There was no tailgating after that. People kept their distance from Merle's car. And after he taught them a lesson, then he took that wire and he threaded it through the upholstery in the back seat, still with the switch under the dashboard. And one day, one night, I remember sitting with him in the car. I was sitting in the passenger seat. And Daryl Magendance, who was the very one he wanted, was sitting in the back seat. And Daryl said, "How much did you pay for this car?" he said, meaning that the 48 Ford wasn't worth much. And Merle said, "Actually, a man paid me to take the car. Paid me $25. Daryl said, "How's that?" "Why? I don't understand." Merle said, "Well, I don't really put much stock in this, but they said that there were ghosts in the car." "I don't think so myself. I had never been aware of any, but they said that the previous owner had been parking late at night on a gravel road, he and his girlfriend, and then a friend and the friend's girlfriend in the back seat, and they were parked there in the dark place, and they were necking, and a hobo came up out of the hobo camp down by the railroad tracks and put his face right up to the window on the girl's side of the back seat. She didn't see him until she turned. She was buttoning up her dress, and she turned, and there was the face, and she let out a scream. And she was never right after that." Never right after that. Well, the boy who was sitting in the back seat, he took off after the hobo and chased him down into the woods and down by the creek, and some of the hobo's pals from the hobo camp were waiting there, and they beat this young man with sticks, and they killed him. And they say that sometimes his ghost appears in the back. I don't place any credence in it at all. But there was this one other thing they told me. And right here, as Daryl was leaning forward to catch the one other thing, Merle reached under the dash, and he flicked the switch, and 20,000 volts came through. And Daryl just turned inside out. He just bounced off the roof a couple of times, and in 1 second flat, he was about 50 feet away. He'd ruined his best clothes. He was off over there. It taught him a lesson that he never forgot. But he wasn't hurt. He wasn't hurt. That was one of the rules. Merle was good with electricity, and one Halloween night he invited me to come to the auto salvage yard. This is back in the time when people would still use parts off old wrecked cars, and they'd go replace them on their cars. They would cannibalize old wrecks, and so old wrecks were kept out there. They weren't compacted and recycled. They were left out in the field, and this was just outside of Millet, up on a hill. There was a row of cars up at the top of the hill that we called Death Row because it was made up of cars that had been in violent traffic accidents. The car that had run into the freight train. The kids who were on their way back from swimming at the gravel pit. They were in a hurry to make it back for graduation. They were killed in that car. They never did find any swim trunks in that car. They just buried those kids and put their car up there on the hill as a warning to the others. Other cars that had hit bridge abutments. And then there was the prom car, the car that the young man and young woman were in a hurry to get home in time for a curfew at midnight. They missed a curve and they ran into a tree at a very high speed, judging from the front of that car. The engine pushed all the way back into the front seat. "Well," he said, "there's some people going to be up visiting Death Row tonight," he said to me on Halloween. And he said, "You and I are going to be in wait for them. We're going to just wait for them to come. Oh, you're going to like this, he said. I've been working all day on this, he said. I'll bet you they're going to crap in their pants. I'll bet you $10. Well, we lay up there in the weeds by this pickup truck, and he wasn't telling me what he'd done. And then these boys came up, and there were three of them, and they stood right up by the prom car, touching it with their hands. You could see there was some kind of bet, some kind of dare going on, and they were scared, all three of them, but they had told somebody they weren't scared and they were going to do this, and so they did it, but they couldn't wait for the time to be up. They lit a match to look at their watch. They were going to be there for just a few minutes. They were smoking cigarettes. We could see the red coals of their cigarettes in the dark. We could smell beer, and we could hear them talk to each other in that cool way that shows that somebody's really, really scared. We waited for a while. You always want to wait for a little while. And then Merle said, okay, here we go. And he picked up a cord. And now I could see around the box of this pickup all of these electrical wires. And I could look into the box of the pickup, and there were like 50 car batteries in there, all wired up in a series. He took that clamp and he put it onto a battery post, and the moment he put it on, six headlights, whoa! And those boys, just frozen in the headlights, looked at us, their eyes big as saucers. There was a radio playing in the last car in the row. Very nice touch on Merle's part, I thought, and really little creativity. And then he took the second clamp and he put it on a second post, and the starter started up on the pickup truck, and it lurched forward towards those boys. We saw dark forms tearing off into the darkness. Then he unhooked the batteries. He sniffed the air. He said, I think I won that bet. That was how we used to celebrate Halloween. We did all sorts of things of that nature. Of course, that was a different day and age. You know, things were a little more primitive then, and you could get away with a lot more. My father celebrated Halloween back in the days of the outdoor privy, and those days passed. Indoor plumbing was hastened by Halloween, because boys like to tip privies. And everybody knew that they did it on Halloween. That was when you did it. And so people were on the watch. But nonetheless, they were waiting for their chance. And they always went for the people who lived up on the hill. The editor of the newspaper and the Lutheran minister and the banker. They went after powerful people who still had outhouses. Because relieving your bowels was a sort of a private thing, and people didn't like to do it in the house, in a room in the house behind an ordinary door. They liked to be by themselves and go off into the outhouse. And for some of them, the key to loosening their bowels was the smell somehow of the outhouse. And it was something they couldn't get over. And so a lot of these outhouses lasted on into the early 20s when my dad was a boy. And those boys would sit up by the church and they would wait on Halloween night. They would wait to see somebody leave his house. Of course, these men knew it was Halloween, and so they tried to hold it in, but it comes a point where you have to go, and so they'd take a lantern and take a rifle, and they'd go out to the outhouse, and they would walk in there and sit down, listening for the sound of boys coming down through the weeds. And ever so often, they'd just throw the door open. They'd say, I see you out there. I know you're out there. They'd say. But those boys weren't fooled by that. They knew that in order for the man to do what he had to do, he had to relax, didn't he? So they waited for the sounds of relaxation. And then they moved quickly. You had to do it right because you weren't supposed to hurt anybody. So four boys pushed from the back and one boy sort of eased it down from the front. They'd always push from the back, tip it over onto the door, and the man would yell at them. That was the payoff for those boys, was hearing some good Lutheran express himself in rich, ripe language. Use words you wouldn't hear him use in ordinary life. That was the whole payoff. And then he had just one exit, was out through the hole. And there was the latrine waiting for him. It was a cruel joke, but it was a good joke. The editor of the paper, Valdemar Starr, went out with a lantern and a rifle, and they rushed that outhouse, they tipped it over on the door, and the lantern fell off, and these two big bottles of Canadian whiskey that he kept stashed up in the rafters fell down and caught on fire. The whole thing blew up, and he came out the door and into the latrine faster than you can bet. He came out the next week. He came out with an editorial against the League of Nations and Woodrow Wilson. You just wouldn't believe the language that he used. There was... became a crusading newspaper after that. But you're always responsible for what happened. You were responsible, no matter what. Those boys who pushed the boxcar onto the grade crossing as a joke for Halloween, they knew they were responsible. Outcome-based morality. It's hard getting that boxcar going off the sidetrack there by the station, but they finally got it going, and it came onto the main line, and they were pushing it toward the grade crossing. It took 40 boys to get that boxcar going, and once they got it going, they couldn't stop it. It didn't stop. It just kept on going. It was rolling down south of town, rolling south of town. They knew they were responsible. It was getting away from them, so they ran. They got a pickup truck, and they drove down the rail line. They got up over the rail and drove along the ties at 10 miles an hour, shook until their teeth almost came out of their head. But still, that boxcar was getting away from them. They didn't know what to do. It was around the bend, and then they went around the bend. They couldn't see it. It was heading south, and then they heard the whistle. They heard the whistle of the oncoming North Coast Limited, and they got that pickup off the rail fast as they could go. They just got it off the rail, and that North Coast Limited came barreling north past them, went by. They went off in search of the boxcar. They never found it. It never was found. Station master said there were two pianos and six sofas inside it. Nobody knows what happened to that boxcar. It's a mystery. Sometimes men deer hunting out south of town have heard piano music. Heard piano music and saw that sofa. Thought of their mothers. All gone. The past gone. Just like a freight train off into the night.